Welcome to the Common Sense Spirituality Show, the show that takes the mystery out of spirituality with your host, David Gagan, engineer, science director, scholarly researcher of life's mysteries, and author of The Endless Journey.
I'm Dave Gagan, host of the Common Sense Spirituality Show. I'd like to welcome you to today's show, Philosophy of Religion. Being seekers of wisdom, we need to search all the databases of thought to understand what's available to us. What better place to begin than to evaluate religion, our old friend or foe, depending on your perspective, and see what key tenets are hidden within its many core beliefs. Today we have a very special guest with us. Some 15 years ago, I read a book titled The World's Wisdom, written by a religious scholar named Dr. Philip Novak. I loved his book because it was clearly written by a man who was seeking truth, as I was and still am. His search was focused on the religions of the world, and as I mentioned last week, religion is one of the major bodies of thought where we can seek spiritual answers. I was so enamored by Dr. Novak's book that I included it in the recommended reading list in my own book, The Endless Journey. Dr. Novak went on to write several other books and is now professor of philosophy in the Dominican University of California, where he teaches, amongst other subjects, the philosophy of religion. It's a treat for me to have Dr. Philip Novak with us today, and I would like to welcome you to the show.
Thank you very much, Michael. It's good to be here.
It's great to be here with you this morning. Now, as a young man, when you were searching for wisdom, why didn't you pursue philosophy of science? Why'd you turn to religion?
Well, for me, it goes back to the books that came across my path at that time. I guess it was my 19th year. And one key book was Carl Jung's Memories, Dreams, Reflections. It's the autobiography of that man, Carl Jung, who was a disciple of Freud's, but differed and broke from Freud precisely on the issue of the importance of religion to the human psyche. Of course, Freud called religion the universal obsessional neurosis of humanity. He thought it was a universal sickness. If you want to pursue wisdom, it's precisely the wrong place to go. But Jung, who was no dummy, brilliant, deeply brilliant in his own way, and very thankful to Freud for many discoveries about the human unconscious, nevertheless, in his researches and seeing thousands of patients during his life, he felt that religion, and when I say religion, in Jung's view, the world's religions, in other words, he was not merely working from the Christian database, as you call it, but from the database of the world's religions, he felt that they were the repository. These world's religions were the repository of ideas, thoughts, and symbols that hold the key to our human spiritual maturity, and really the key to our deep happiness beyond that which we can attain through normal worldly success and maturity and that kind of thing. So it was from Jung's emphasis on the psychological importance of the wisdoms often lying beneath static in the world's religions that turned me on, you might say, to religion. Because as a young man, I had rejected religion, thinking that it was just what had been taught to me as a boy. It wasn't of interest to me anymore. I was ready to go on to a different career. But reading about the psychological power and potency of religious ideas in a great psychologist like Jung made me want to study religion and psychology. And that was my first turn away, you might say, from philosophy of science. Jung was a scientist, and I was aware of science, and I was aware I had to keep my knowledge of science up. But I didn't want to go in that direction professionally. I wanted to blaze a trail at least toward the kind of thing Jung did. It's a long story. I don't want to talk too long about why I didn't become a Jungian psychologist or something like that, and why I went the academic route to study mythology and the world's religions. But that's pretty much the answer.
Okay. So you see that religion is kind of an innate. Innate within the human psyche, as opposed to an acquired crutch that we might use to get us through the difficulties of life.
Well, yes, I believe it's innate. When you say acquired crutch, there's something of that too. But let me. We certainly have an innate propensity for religion. It's we now know, anthropologists who aren't religious believers at all admit that religion is a cultural universal. Wherever we found human groups, as old as we can find, and in modern day, we find religion. It's not that every individual is religious, but we've never found a human group that lasted any amount of time without something called religion. Now, whether that religion is from an innate sense of there being a divine dimension, or whether it comes out of purely cross-cultural needs that are psychological and social in their rootedness, is another question altogether. In other words, we do have innate psychological and social needs. We have an innate social need to build moral community, to get moral agreement among the people in our society so we can have a certain amount of agreement about what's good and what's bad. We do have a need to therapize ourselves in the face of, if I may use that term, therapize, in the face of death and suffering and incomprehensibility, and tell ourselves consoling stories. Many people say that's what's innate in us, that need for moral community and the need to have some kind of psychological comfort in the face of life's difficulties. And out of those innate needs, we create religions as crutches to help us deal with those sociological and psychological needs. That's one whole side of the picture. I see it. I'm aware of it. But there's also another side that suggests, in addition to those psychological and social needs that religion serving very natural propensities, in other words, that religion also comes out of direct contact with a spiritual reality. In other words, it comes out of experiences that rise above or are distinct from our innate needs as psychosocial beings.
Yeah. Okay. You know, a lot of people are down on religion. You know, they look at the Catholic Church, for example, and see the upper echelon living in the lap of luxury while priests molest children and poverty goes unchecked. And then they see the Islamic leaders preaching terrorism and slaughtering fellow Muslims simply because they believe in different Islamic heritage. What would you say to people who read the papers every day and see religion really at its worst?
Yes, well, I'd say you're seeing something real and truly ugly, and there's simply no way of apologizing for it or blinking or something like that. Religion, what comes out of religion, or what can come out of the human religious capacity, can be horrible and terrible, full of violence, persecution, women's subordination, all sorts of intolerance and cruelty. There's no doubt that that is part of religion's record on this planet. Now, of course, I'm not an apologist for religion, but an apologist for religion might say, though religious people may be doing those things or claiming to do so in the name of religion, they don't understand their own religion, or they're precisely going against it because their understanding of it is perverted. Jesus' teaching was so-and-so, and Muhammad or the Quran's teaching was so-and-so, and you see all the horrible things that are going on in the world are perversions of true Christianity or true Islam. I partly agree with that. But I don't want at all to suggest to your listeners that those horrors don't come out of some kind of religious context. The key question is there bathwater? Is there a baby in the bathwater? Along with the muck, are there gems that have always been there that can be rediscovered and maybe even begin or be allies to us in trying to overcome our centuries-old misuse of a religion as a rallying cry for
anything we want to do,
nationalism,
really.
for other egoic goals. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, you bring that up, and you've spent your life studying the great religions. Did you find some common core beliefs which cross all the religions, you know, which you consider universal truths, if you will, or at least truths as far as religion is concerned?
Yes, I have. And as the host, Dave, you need to guide me through how much you want to do, because I could lapse almost into a long lecture. I hope it would be interesting, but you need to pull me back where you want in order to put some commas,
you know,
and periods
in. So what we'll do is you know, why don't you start, and then you know, well, let's go through them one at a time, and
sure.
And let's talk about them and see,
sure,
you know, make sure we all understand what they are.
Sure. Let me introduce the first few that I'll mention by invoking a name, Father Thomas Keating. Father Thomas Keating is a Trappist Catholic monk who, as monks do, gave his life to the search for God, living in a monastery in Snowmass, Colorado, for most of his life, an abbot there for some time, but you know, living a life of prayer and total silence and reading. But in those years, I guess back in the 60s, the 70s, he was reading widely, and he realized that people of other religions were also contemplatives who entered deep silence in the name of Hinduism or in the name of Buddhism or in the name of Islam or Judaism or Native American religions. And he wondered, despite the surface differences between all these religions, whether there was some common ground. So he began to invite wise representatives of these many religions to Snowmass once a year for conferences, and they met over a 30-year period. Representatives of Judaism and Islam, Christianity, Taoism, Confucianism, and indeed the world's great religions. And over 30 years, of course, they all sensed that they were on the same track. But it's difficult when you try and put those common agreements into language. So they worked and worked and refined and wordsmithed their thoughts, and they came up with a list of 8 points of agreement across the world's religions. Number one that came out of these 30 years of interreligious dialogue is this: the world's religions bear witness to the experience of ultimate reality to which they give various names. Now, that alone is of tremendous importance. Of course, not everybody's going to just agree, but what they're saying is we name God by different names, but those are only names. There's something behind all the names that human beings shower upon the relatedness they feel to a spiritual dimension. Don't take those names or the human developments of all the theologies and philosophies regarding those names as the ultimate itself. God is always beyond any name we can call him. And the philosophical way to say that is there is an ultimate reality to which human communities have given many names in their search for relatedness to that ultimate reality.
So that ultimate reality is basically saying God exists. All the religions think God exists. Is that a summary of it?
That's the ultimate good. Reality. That's good. But you see, you got it exactly right, David. I'm only being a persnickety philosopher when I say all religions say ultimate reality exists. Because when you say God, you're naming that ultimate reality by a particular religious vocabulary, namely Judeo-Christianity.
Gotcha.
There are other terms for God. But yes, if you want to use the term God in quotes to say that, and that takes care of God and the Muslim Brahman and the Arabic Allah and the Taoist Tao, that's fine. But that's why we use the term ultimate reality, so we don't slip into a particular God language of a particular culture.
Okay.
It's a way of respecting all God languages, but saying that they all point to something that we'll call ultimate reality, a philosophical term that you don't find in any particular religion, but that can illuminate them all.
Okay, sounds good.
Okay, second point of the Snowmass interreligious dialogue. Ultimate reality cannot be limited by any name or concept. Wonderful that these men and women said to one another, let's not, we feel we're naming ultimate reality, but let's not overvalue any particular name we give it, even though it has a 2,000, 3,000 year history, and we love the names we give to God, and we build our liturgies and our rituals around them. God cannot be limited, ultimate reality cannot be limited by any name. The word God or Brahman or Tao, it can't be by any name or concept, suggesting that the ultimate reality in its own isness transcends any concept that a human mind can project upon it.
Okay.
Third point, ultimate reality is the ground of infinite potentiality and actualization. That is a wonderful statement, interreligious, that all their God ideas or ultimate reality ideas are ideas of a creative source of the world. Now, of course, these may all be, somebody might say, yeah, these are all wrong. I'm not arguing whether they're true or false. I'm saying that spiritual people from various religions, in looking for agreement, say, yes, we agree that whatever this ultimate reality is, it's a creative source. It's that out of which all things come. All the potential for human growth, for cosmic evolution, for biological evolution, for human growth and potential all come ultimately from this source. Number four, it has to do with faith, and they distinguish between faith and mere belief, which most people just feel are synonyms of one another. But they say it this way, number four, faith is opening, accepting, and responding to that ultimate reality. Faith in this sense precedes every belief system. So they're drawing attention here to the fact that all 7.2 billion of us on planet Earth are capable of having a faith response to that ultimate dimension that they call ultimate reality. But in doing so, often sometimes we learn how to do so through a particular belief system because we're raised as Christians or as Hindus or as Buddhists, and we begin to relate to that ultimate reality through a particular belief system. But the fundamental movement of faith comes before and underlies any particular set of beliefs in concepts and practices of a particular religion. It's the sort of pure relatedness to this ultimate reality by a human mind, and not just that openness and accepting and this willingness to respond to ultimate reality. That's the essential movement of faith in the human organism.
Okay, so you're saying that the basis of faith is inherent within us, and the question would be faith in the fact that there is an ultimate reality. I mean, we can have faith in a lot of things, but you're saying that part of faith, I mean, you know, you can have faith in almost anything, but that part of faith in the fact that there's an ultimate reality, that's the piece of faith you're talking about here.
Yes, but of course, don't make the mistake that I'm saying there really, I mean, I, Philip Novak, as the author, speaking to you, I'm not claiming there is an ultimate reality. Right. I'm reporting to you what a group of religious people who spent their lives in religions and spirituality claim they share in common, or their understanding of faith is an innate property in human beings that opens and responds, that opens the human being and causes or encourages the human being to respond to this ultimate spiritual reality. Yes.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
Fifth, the potential for human wholeness, or in other frames of reference, enlightenment, salvation, transcendence, transformation, blessedness. In other words, these are all terms for that which spirituality or religion ultimately seek. We seek a state of human wholeness, or sometimes called enlightenment, sometimes called salvation, sometimes called transcendence, sometimes transformation, sometimes beatitude or blessedness. But that potential, they say, this group of interreligious dialoguers, is present in every human being. There's no human being born without this fundamental potential.
Okay.
Sixth, ultimate reality may be experienced not only through religious practices, but also through nature, art, human relationships, and service to others. I thought this was very far-seeing of these people. They are representatives of religion. They were from noted religious traditions, but they're saying, you know what? You can contact or have this feeling for or relatedness to ultimate reality quite outside of anything called religion or the institution of religion. It could come through an experience of art, through an experience of love of another person, through service to other people, whether you have a creed or not. They're saying that mode of relatedness to ultimate reality does not have to be conditioned by or made possible through an institution, a religion.
That's interesting, coming from people that all are within an institution of a religion.
Yes, it is. And frankly, I think that's right. I think they're exactly right in saying that. And I think that if religions think that you can only derive a relationship to ultimate reality through their practices, or their doctrines, I think they're sadly mistaken. And that, of course, that could be taken a lot farther. But let me go on with the list. There are only two more.
Okay.
Number seven, as long as the human condition is experienced as separate from ultimate reality, it is subject to ignorance and illusion, weakness and suffering. So here's where they grasp the doctrine of evil, or the sense of if God is there, if ultimate reality is there, why are things so screwed up on Earth? Why do we humans have such rough times? Now, of course, this is not a huge diagnosis. This is a single sentence statement. But their viewpoint as religious contemplatives from all over the world is that it's precisely when we don't understand that we are already deeply related to the ultimate reality, we're already innately connected to it, that it's out of that missed connection, or the unawareness of that connection to God, if you want to put it in Western terms, that all selfishness, self-regard, out of which comes ignorance and illusion, weakness and suffering. But that's the fundamental illusion, the fundamental break, this lack of awareness of our pre-connectedness, you might say, to the divine reality. And finally, number 8, discipline practice is essential to spiritual life. Yet, spiritual attainment is not the result of one's own efforts, but the result of the experience of oneness with ultimate reality.
Explain that one.
Yeah. They're trying to say that there's nothing wrong with spiritual practice. If you want to meditate, if you want to do yoga, if you want to go to mass, if you want to do whatever prayer sequences, any kind of ritual psychological practices, they all might be entering into silence for days, going on retreats. Those all might be important. And they could contribute to your spiritual maturity, but there's no guarantee. There are just no guarantees in life in general, it seems. But there's no guarantee that following any kind of formula is going to produce over such amount of time, or you've said so many rosaries or done so many meditation retreats, that's going to produce some degree of enlightenment. Always it happens. Now, I'll use a Western term, because this very word wouldn't be used by all the religions, but I think that's what's being gotten to here in number 8, is it's a matter of grace. So they're saying it's good to practice, it's good to cultivate openness to that ultimate reality, but whether or not that openness leads to, how shall I say, fulfillment, is not quite up to you. It's up to it's up to interconnections and conditions that are always beyond you, because you're in a total matrix of interconnected events which you can't control. The best you can do is humbly open yourself over life to this reality as you understand it, and if that experience comes, or as it comes, or as it deepens, then what? You enjoy and learn from that, but you can't make it happen. You can't say, because I've done X, Y, and Z, therefore I've climbed the spiritual ladder, or I'm this much enlightened, or something like that. Right. You can't quantify it.
Yeah, I'll tell you, those I don't, you know, I look at those 8 and I don't recognize any religion in them. But they would make a great religion.
That's funny.
Wouldn't they?
David, that's funny that you say that. I recognize all religions in them.
Okay.
Yes, I don't know why you say you recognize no religion, but
I see no religion that just follows that. But I do agree with you. Each one has that piece in it.
Oh, okay.
Maybe I said it wrong for you.
No, I got it now. You might say there's no religion whose doctrines are only these. That's true. They're trying to see, you know, religions have been around at least 40,000 to 50,000 years since we developed language as human beings, and maybe even prior to that, though it's hard to tell. The archaeology of religion is another whole subject. Perhaps we shouldn't get into that here. But over time, things get just layered and encrusted and built over. There are tremendous ramifications of initial insights. And you might say the world's religions that we have them are highly ramified cultural vehicles with all sorts of permutations and dimensions to them. This was an attempt by religious scholars and practicing contemplatives to have an X-ray vision into the deepest intentions of their religious traditions. And this is the 8 they came up with. But no religion will just sound like this purely. And by the way, these eight statements are very much what I call the philosophy of religion. They're not an attempt to start a new religion based on these 8, all the people who made this list of eight would laugh at that. They'd say, we're not trying to start a new religion with eight new tenets and a new name for God. These are just philosophical abstractions, but in the best sense of that word, philosophical abstractions trying to say what all religions at their depth have in common.
Yeah. Do you think these are, divinely inspired? You know, do you think that the leaders that started these religions, and I guess each religion had some founder or group of founders, mostly a single, I guess, that came up with a certain set of revelations, if you will, or beliefs. You know, do you think they were inspired by some spiritual source, or do you think these were just smart people that said, "Hey, this is what I think"? You think it's
revelation? In one sense, neither. But I got your question, and I think I can respond to the spirit of it. I'm making a broad generalization. We'd have to go one by one across religion, but that would take too much time. So the broad generalization is the founders of religions weren't just smart people. They were knocked off their feet by something. They had deep experiences. You could say, if you wish, it's divine inspiration. Or you could say it was a mystical or peak experience. In either case, something profound happened to these men and women. They felt themselves to be in touch with a different reality than is normally available to human consciousness. We know that people report this kind of thing all the time, but maybe some people have it in such a high degree that they can't but begin to speak about it, and in their persons might be the creative geniuses that become the founders of religions. But I put the emphasis on the depth and power of the religious experiences of the founders of religions. And of course, they couldn't have those experiences. Well, they would say, I couldn't have those experiences unless there was a reality that I was experiencing. So if you want to call that divine inspiration, but I just don't want to let the word divine inspiration lead us to think that there's a God above the clouds kind of waving a magic wand and sort of inspiring people with a bolt of lightning when he feels like it. I think that, although a childish picture, is too simple and not intended by the people, for instance, the bright people that wrote up these eight points at Snowmass. I think they see it more that Jesus and the Buddha and Muhammad had profound openings and experiences and spoke and taught out of those, and that's how religion started.
Okay. Do you think religions need to try to come back to these fundamental principles, or do you think very much so?
There's something called the World Parliament of Religions that meets to draw representatives of all the world's religions together. We know there's still a cacophony, a kind of Tower of Babel out there, but we're just beginning. Comparative religion is only 100 years old on this planet, whereas religion is probably 100,000 years old. We've only in the last 100 years began to translate and interpret to a great depth each other's scriptures. We're very early in the process of interreligious dialogue, and the more we dialogue, the more it will become clear to people in religions. I mean, we hope this will happen. What is essential and what is peripheral? And as we come to know what is more and more essential, there'll be more and more of these kinds of lists, it seems, to which people will see, oh, that's what's being gotten at underneath all the bells and whistles and symbolic ramifications of my religion. So that's very much the hope. It's going to be a long cultural journey, But still now, there's a tremendous amount of talking, religions talking past one another, not being able to see past their symbolisms to some kind of deeper agreement.
How do our listeners work their way through it? I mean, you know, they're not religious scholars. They're people that are just trying to get through life, and they go when they look at religion, and if they're listening to this show, it's probably one of two or three religions that they're more likely to go through, and how do they look at it and they say, okay, I'll buy into this piece, but I won't buy into that piece. How do they decide? I mean, obviously, we got the eight principles here. There may be more value in religion than the eight, I would think. How do people decide that?
They do it through their own intuition and rational judgment. I don't know, and their common sense. I don't know a better way. There are going to be errors, but it has to be an individual discernment. I mean, they can listen to an authority, they can take their pastor's advice or the advice of a friend or something like that, but finally, it's their exploration, step by step, conversation by conversation, and I might say, book by book. What are they going to read? There are some things out there that are not written for religious scholars, but attempt to get at this level of commonality and help guide people, you might say, through the world's the world's spiritual riches, so that they too might discern what will work for them, even while they remain a Christian or a Jew or a Muslim. And I can mention some great titles if you'd like.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Well. Now this is an older title, but a man named Aldous Huxley, who wrote was a novelist, but also a deeply spiritual man, wrote a book called The Perennial Philosophy, in which he tried to suggest that all religions were pointing at the same truths. He wouldn't have put it in the form of these eight truths. He puts it in four formulations, but it wrote a whole book. Taking quotations from the various religions of the world, showing, you might say, giving proof texts to his assertion that all the religions had these virtues, these hopes, these assertions in common. It's a wonderful book to start with, it seems to me, the Perennial Philosophy.
That was the one, as I recall. It's been a while since I've read that, but I thought he came. The four that he came up with, and these aren't his words; they'd be mine, were that there is some divine intelligence has created everything, and you know, he who seeks shall find, and intuition is better than intellectual reasoning, and I think his third one was something to the tune of, we're eternal beings and part of a divine intelligence, and the fourth was that, you know, the purpose of life on Earth is to learn that we're a part of the divine intelligence, which all kind of falls in with your eight, I think.
Oh, it does very much fall in, as I say, Huxley's four. The four that you just mentioned, which are roughly correct. Fall in quite well with the points of agreement, the eight points of agreement I read from the Snowmass people.
Right.
If we put them side by side and sat down, we could see the overlaps. But Huxley doesn't just say those four. He builds a whole book of quotations from the various religions around those four. And I think they could be very inspirational to people on their journey.
Okay, great.
Yeah, another book, Patrick Burke's classic, The Fragile Universe, a very slim volume, very easy to read, but a beautiful rendition of what religions have in common and our common human venture toward the spirit. Another book by Paul Knitter, K-N-I-T-T-E-R, called No Other Name with a question mark. No Other Name. He was a Christian brother, I think still is, but entered deeply into this interreligious understanding in this book, No Other Name. In other words, can we know God by other names than God? And his answer is very much, with his knowledge of the world's religions, yes. And it can be read by anyone without, it seems to me, any special education in theology to their great benefit. There's one more book I want to mention because it's meant a great deal to me, and I think he's the finest writer on these issues around. It was a Christian, he was a Christian during his life, but a great philosopher of religion. His name is John Hick, that's H-I-C-K, no S, John Hick, and one of his many books is called God Has Many Names. It's a beautiful piece, gets precisely at these issues of what religions have in common and what religious interreligious dialogue is what its task is planetarily before us as we move toward a greater religious unity on this planet.
Yeah, I'll tell you, those are great ideas. And I, you know, this, if you didn't write them down, listeners, you can get this radio station in a couple of weeks. This radio show will be on iHeartRadio, so you can get those again. I think they're great places to start. Absolutely outstanding. You know when I look at faith, I think you're absolutely right about the faith being something that allows us to appreciate the ultimate reality, if you will. But I look at it as coming in two parts, because we're asked to have faith from our religion and, quite frankly, from science and other things, and we're asked to have it in an awful lot of things. And I look at it, faith is coming in two pieces. And if we eat well, for example, and exercise often, and we don't smoke and do drugs and drink alcohol excessively, and we see a doctor regularly, I think, you know, we can have faith that we'll have a long, healthy life. But if we consume junk food and are a couch potato and have a drug or alcohol or smoking habit, never visit a doctor, well, we can still have faith that we'll have a long life. But that's blind faith. And faith requires reason and effort. And we need to look at what we're being told and see how does it feel inside? Does it feel right or doesn't it feel right? And if it feels right and you've put the effort into it, then I'd say, you know, you're probably in the right place and go with it.
I like where you put the emphasis there in terms of emphasis on the person's own common sense, their heart, their emotions, also their reason. Faith shouldn't be blind. That is to say, a mere acceptance of authority. If I were to, I think you might be describing faith a little broadly in terms, meaning that I think the thing you said about if we do this, if we do X, Y, and Z, we can have faith that we will be healthy. I would call that just mere expectation. If we do X, Y, and Z, we have an expectation that this would occur, and certain causes certain effects proceed from certain causes, and that sort of thing. What I'm calling faith is something I think a little more narrowly defined, perhaps, than merely a kind of expectation of, if X, Y, and Z happens, if I do X, Y, and Z, then A, B, and C will occur. We're asked to believe a lot of things on authority. I mean, do you know how television exactly works? Do you know exactly all the electronics and engineering of radio that is allowing us to talk to one another? I mean,
probably
could you build
not.
A radio station from scratch right now?
Probably not.
What?
I say probably not.
Right. We believe a lot of things that people tell us because we don't have a chance to figure them out all by ourselves. And we have to drive a car without understanding it. We believe, but all those things that we believe in, that we take on authority and need to because life is too short for us to sort of reinvestigate everything, I wouldn't call that faith. I want to reserve faith. I mean, and it would just be purely personal. I'd be stipulating. I couldn't pass a law that says you and everybody must only speak of faith in my way. But personally, I would rather just use faith for a very particular dimension of human behavior having to do with the human capacity to open itself up to take a risk of living their lives in terms of response to an ultimate spiritual reality. Something
that is,
like that.
Narrow. That, yes. Yeah. Okay. I see that. See, I look at faith more that, you know, you go to church, for example. Say you're Episcopalian, like I used to be. You know, the if you start questioning the dogma, it's, well, you have to have faith. Well, that's a broad amount of faith because the dogma is a broad amount. They're not asking you to have faith on some small aspect of it.
Yeah, well, I don't know who said you have to have faith when you started questioning. You see, to me, that's anti-intellectual, and pastors ought not to do that. But it seems to me my Episcopalian friends, or at least the Episcopalians that I know, and of course, because of my profession of being a college teacher and a writer, I'm talking to other Episcopalians with the same sort of background, they would say, okay, all right, you have a question about dogma? Well, then you have to try and resolve it. You shouldn't just sit there and believe because we say you ought to believe. That's not faith. Faith is an active questioning, seeking that even involves doubt, whereas belief, mere belief, these are the set of propositions I believe, they're my insurance policy into heaven. That's something else. Belief is very common, and lots of people believe and are told to believe by their religious and non-religious authorities. But faith is something I want to keep separate and special and not get it mixed up with mere belief, even though language always mixes those, common usage always mixes those two up. Faith is this openness, this seeking, this openness in the experience of doubt, because faith is an open venture. It's a risk-taking. There's never, you might say, that's why we call it faith. It's not a guarantee. It's not, I believe in A, B, and C, therefore I'm saved. I believe in A, B, and C, therefore I can put that to rest and go and live the rest of my life.
Yeah. Faith hey, I love it. I love it. I think you're absolutely right. And it's well put. We're running out of time here, so sure. I'm going to have to close down on this.
No problem,
Dr. Novak. You have been a great guest and have provided us tremendous insight. And I really appreciate you coming by today. It's been an outstanding learning experience for all of us.
Well, thank you, Michael. I've had an interesting time as well.
Oh, great. Now, obtaining wisdom is a long process, and as no one can bestow it on us. The more we talk and hear other sides and other ideas, the more we'll be able to mature our own views. You can contact me through my website at davidgagan.com. Your note will go straight into my personal email, and I hope to hear from you in regards to today's show and ideas for future topics. I cover all of these in my book, The Endless Journey, which you can pick up on the website or at Amazon. Now, next week, we'll have Peter Russell with us, and we will discuss consciousness and why science doesn't accept it in its paradigm. I look forward to sharing our thoughts every Friday morning at 9 a.m. here on W4CY.com. Truth is indeed stranger than fiction. And it turns out to be an amazingly good news story. We all have a great destiny ahead of us. Let me leave you with one last thought. You are a unique spirit having a life experience. You are far more important in the grander scheme of things than you can possibly realize. Enjoy your life. You've earned it.